The headlines: a strong earthquake rips through Afghanistan. A total of 280 people are dead in eastern cities near Pakistan's border. Almost 4 months into Russia's offensive, Ukraine says its forces are under massive artillery shelling in an eastern city, in a city that is in the eastern Donbass region. And in Ecuador, an indigenous protester dies in clashes with police during a ninth day of demonstrations against the government. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Let's begin with the latest developments about the earthquake that jolted several provinces in eastern Afghanistan hours ago. The Interior Ministry says the death toll is now over 280. The 6.1 magnitude quake has wounded hundreds more. The Taliban Disaster Management Authority says most of the deaths have been reported in the province of Paktika. Also, there have been casualties in Nangarhar and Khost. According to a U.S. Geological Survey, the quake's epicenter was about 44 kilometers from the city of Khost. It was also felt in neighboring Pakistan, but so far no reports of damage or casualties from that side of the border. The Palestinian Health Ministry says a young man has been stabbed to death by an Israeli settler in the occupied West Bank. The ministry says a man, 28 years old, was stabbed directly in the heart. Witnesses say he was working on his land near a settlement when a group of settlers attacked him. The witnesses also say Israeli troops started shooting at Palestinians who were trying to reach the scene. Resistance movement Hamas has slammed the killing, saying it was a direct result of Israel's policy to let settlers practice organized terrorism against Palestinians. Moving on, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the military situation is very difficult in the eastern region of Luhansk, with Russia intensifying its assault to capture the Donbass region.
The situation on the front line hasn't significantly changed. Thanks to tactical maneuvers, the Ukrainian army is strengthening its defense in the Luhansk region. That is the really toughest spot. The occupiers are pressing strongly and also in the Donetsk direction in the Kharkiv region.
Ukrainian officials say Russian shelling has killed 15 people, including a child in Kharkiv. They say Russian forces have taken control of several settlements near the embattled cities of Lysychansk and Severodonetsk. In the Luhansk region, the twin cities are seeing the most fierce fighting. According to Luhansk governor, the Russians are massively shelling Lysychansk, but the Ukrainian troops are holding their ground. The war, which began nearly 4 months ago, is now focused on the eastern Donbass region. Staying with Ukraine, President Zelensky says he'll do everything for the country's candidacy to the European Union to be approved. Ukraine launched the bid immediately after Russia began its war there. Despite pledges by EU leaders, Kiev's road to full EU membership doesn't seem to be an easy one. Jerome Hughes has the details from Brussels.
EU leaders held video calls throughout Tuesday to prepare for a summit on Thursday and Friday, at which Ukraine and Moldova will be granted candidate status, which means they move a step closer to joining the 27-country bloc. Georgia will be placed to a stage just below candidate status. EU affairs ministers also met on Tuesday to lay the groundwork.
That's, I think, a very important message. And it's a very important message which comes in a special time where we see this renewed geopolitical rivalry, new global tensions.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted, "Ukrainians are ready to die for the European perspective. We want them to live with us, the European dream." Not everyone is impressed, given the current state of the EU.
I'd say the Ukrainians would rather live than die. And I'd say now the notion that they want to die for any European dream is a bit fanciful now at best.
Moscow is clearly being told to take note that the EU family is growing.
This is a powerful signal. This is a powerful signal that should be heard, not only in Ukraine.
But the message seems to have fallen flat on its face. Vladimir Putin says he's no objections to Ukraine joining the EU. The Kremlin's issue has always been related to Kiev becoming a member of the NATO military alliance. It's been reported that officials in the European Commission filled out the country's EU application form. A number of legislators point out the EU's own studies have found that Ukraine is highly corrupt. Therefore, they suggest the country is not eligible. Analysts say it could take up to 10 years for Ukraine to become a full member of the bloc.
In this context, it has been suggested by some lawmakers here that the true motive is to yet again use Ukraine as a pawn to try and undermine Russia. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, official figures show China's oil imports from Russia have significantly increased despite the West's efforts to put a complete ban on Russian oil exports. China's customs data show oil shipments from Russia increased by 55% in May compared to a year earlier. The country has imported over 8.4 million tons of Russian oil last month. That hit a record level and displaced Saudi Arabia as China's biggest supplier of oil so far. The new figures also suggest that Russia has been successful in finding new buyers outside of Europe. The 27-member EU previously agreed to ban most of Russia's energy imports. By the end of 2022, the bloc's executive arm warned that the embargo would make it difficult for the Kremlin to export its energy products to the rest of the world. The UK is facing its biggest rail strike in decades. Tens of thousands of workers have walked out calling for better pay and job security. They've rejected a pay rise of 2% while inflation is at 9%. Unions have warned the strike will lead to coordinated action with other industries. Sait Puduza reports from London.
Day one of a three-day strike that's made London's underground network grind to a crawl. Stations normally teeming with people, either closed or offering only a skeletal service. The advice from the authorities, take the bus. And that has meant scenes like this. Prime Minister Boris Johnson criticized the biggest strike in Britain in a generation as an unnecessary aggravation.
I want to emphasize to everybody this morning why I think those strikes are so wrong, and so unnecessary.
An inconvenience it may be, but the unions say the government left them no choice.
Some of our members have not had a pay rise for the third anniversary now. We can resolve that if we've got a proper negotiating framework. But the fact is that Grant Shapps, Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson are dictating the terms of this dispute. Now, they can either facilitate a settlement or they can block one. At the moment, they're blocking one.
And all this, of course, comes with a cost to the City of London and to the people.
The London Chamber of Commerce says the cost of a strike like this to London's economy is tens of millions of dollars a day. But perhaps the biggest impact this strike is having is the headache it's causing to the nearly 5 million commuters who use the underground to get from A to B on a daily basis.
I think, you know, it's holding people to ransom.
I would say a major inconvenience.
I support the workers getting the right pay they need, and obviously they work really hard. But it's hard not to get annoyed when your journey time is double.
As a teacher, as someone who's just graduating into a profession where there has not been a real terms pay rise in 9 years, I look to the rail workers and I look to the RMT as a beacon of hope.
The strike has shown how dependent London is on its underground network and how powerful unions are. Negotiations for a compromise are ongoing, and so are the strikes. And it doesn't stop with the rail workers. Other professions, such as teaching and healthcare, are also considering industrial action in the UK's summer of unrest. Sait Puruza, London.
In Ecuador, anti-government protests led by indigenous people turned violent, leaving one protester dead. The protester lost his life after being hit in the face with a tear gas bomb fired by security forces. A deadly confrontation happened during the ninth day of demonstrations against the government's economic policy. Scores of people have been injured and arrested during the violence. Thousands of protesters from across the country have filled the streets of the capital, Quito. They're calling for cheaper fuel and control over food prices. The president has announced plans to help vulnerable people, but has failed to appease the protesters. Over the past 2 years, diesel prices have almost doubled in Ecuador. The country is dealing with rising inflation, unemployment, and poverty. Things have become even worse because of the coronavirus pandemic. U.S. officials admit that police response to a school shooting in the state of Texas was, quote, an abject failure. This came about a month after the deadly shooting that killed 19 students and two teachers.
There's compelling evidence that the law enforcement response to the attack at Robb Elementary was an abject failure and antithetical to everything we've learned over the last two decades since the Columbine massacre. 3 minutes after the subject entered the West Building, there was sufficient number of armed officers wearing body armor to isolate, distract, and neutralize the subject. The only thing stopping a hallway of dedicated officers from entering room 111 and 112 was the on-scene commander, who decided to place the lives of officers before the lives of children.
McCraw was testifying before a Texas State Senate hearing on the response to the mass shooting at the school in the city of Uvalde. He said the on-site commander made terrible decisions and officers at the scene lacked sufficient training, costing valuable time that may have saved lives. The probe results came as students' parents and relatives are expressing deep anger over the police response. They've called on the police officer who led the response operation to resign. The officer claims he never considered himself the incident commander of the scene and did not order police to hold back on breaching the building. According to Uvalde Mayor, the district attorney has asked the city not to release records related to the probe into the shooting. And Yemenis are still suffering from the consequences of the Saudi-led war on their country, despite the UN truce entering its third month. Abdel Latif Al-Washali has the story.
Amid a decline in military operations since the UN ceasefire took effect in April, the number of victims of banned weapons in Yemen keeps rising. Remnants of Saudi cluster bombs are taking more lives as Riyadh refuses to allow badly needed equipment, including mine detectors, to enter the war-torn country. Yemen's Mine Action Center reported 120 cases since the start of the truce, 26 of them in the first third of June.
Since the beginning of this year, 326 people have fallen victim to leftover cluster bombs. 120 of them alone have been killed since the start of the truce. The bombings of the Saudi-led coalition continue to claim the lives of innocent citizens on a daily basis. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has been preventing the entry of necessary equipment for years, even though our work is for humanitarian purposes. Therefore, we believe that the coalition seeks to kill civilians even after the end of the war.
The Mine Action Center says the Saudi-led coalition has prevented the entry of mine detectors to Sana'a since 2018 for no good reason, and field teams are still working despite all the risks.
The biggest problem that the center faces is the lack of mine detectors and field equipment. We have been facing this problem since the outset, and unfortunately, the devices and personal protection equipment were not provided even throughout the years of war. In 2018, the United Nations informed us that our equipment had arrived in Djibouti. But much to our surprise, part of it was held by the Saudi-led coalition and some was handed over to other parties not affiliated with us, and we have not received anything until this moment.
During the seven-year war, the Saudi-led coalition has used 15 types of internationally prohibited cluster bombs in its attacks against residential areas across Yemen. However, officials say relevant international organizations refrain from cooperating for political reasons.
People here are dying due to the remnants of internationally banned weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition. Experts believe the number of victims will continue to rise unless the coalition allows the needed equipment to defuse the weapons that kill Yemeni women and children to enter Yemen. Abdel Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Thousands of Iranian pilgrims have arrived in the Saudi city of Medina after years of longing for a trip to the land of revelation before going to the holy city of Mecca. The pilgrims visit the Prophet Muhammad's mosque and other holy sites in Medina. Mahdi Abbasian has more.
Shedding tears of joy after years of longing for the chance to visit a land described as the land of revelation in the Holy Quran, thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, or the city of the Prophet, as it hosts the final resting place of the Prophet Muhammad. Direct flights from Iran arrive in Saudi cities of Medina and Jeddah and will continue until 4th of July. A large number of Iranian pilgrims will first stay in Medina for 6 days and five nights to visit the Prophet's mosque and the Baqi Cemetery, among other sites, before leaving for Mecca to perform the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
Being in a place that the Holy Prophet Muhammad and her daughter Lady Fatima, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein had been is an amazing spiritual experience.
I've been to lots of holy shrines, but here I feel different. I feel absolute peace and detached from the world.
The outbreak of the coronavirus limited trips to Mecca and Medina for 2 years, with only a limited number of Saudi pilgrims being allowed to perform it over the period. Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, while many of them have been awaiting for as long as 15 years. Going around the Prophet's mosque, you can see Iranians overwhelmed with emotions, most of them describing their visit to Medina as a unique experience.
It's impossible to describe the atmosphere in the Prophet's mosque. You can't understand how it feels until you visit the mosque.
I feel God has bestowed His blessing upon me to be the pilgrim of the Prophet's tomb and be in this spiritual environment. It's truly exceptional.
In 2019, the last Hajj before the outbreak of the coronavirus, about 85,000 Iranian pilgrims visited Saudi Arabia. But this year, with the reduction of quotas in Islamic countries, nearly 40,000 people from Iran are allowed to participate in the annual event.
Thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, and many more are on their way to get to this holy city. This is while many more Iranians, thousands, have to wait for at least another year so that they maybe get the chance to visit this holy city once in their life. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
And that's a wrap for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In a powerful warning on Thursday, 16th of June, the patron saint of the conservative legal movement, former federal appellate judge J. Michael Luttig, testified before the January 6th committee and pronounced former President Donald J. Trump and his allies a clear and present danger to American constitutional democracy. The article you're about to hear is an opinion editorial published by the Los Angeles Times. It has been written by Lawrence H. Tribe, a professor emeritus of constitutional law at Harvard University, Philip Allen Lacovara, a former deputy solicitor general of the United States and counsel to the Watergate special prosecutor who argued the case of United States versus Nixon, and Dennis Aftergut, a former federal prosecutor. The article is titled, The insurrection won't end until Trump is prosecuted and disqualified from future office. In a powerful warning on Thursday, 16th of June, the patron saint of the conservative legal movement, former federal appellate judge J. Michael Luttig, testified before the January 6th committee and pronounced former President Donald J. Trump and his allies a clear and present danger to American constitutional democracy. As Judge Luttig knows better than most, this historic phrase generates an extraordinary constitutional power of government to act and a duty to do so. Judge Luttig's verdict should be understood as a plea for Attorney General Merrick Garland to proceed towards charging Donald Trump with federal crimes that the public record now amply establishes. Only then will this nation be able to move forward from the ongoing insurrection. Beyond the avalanche of documents and testimony pointing to Donald Trump's guilt and the principle that no one is above the law, there is an additional reason to indict Donald Trump for his multifaceted conspiracy in 2020 to override the vote. Upon a conviction for inciting insurrection or being an accessory to insurrection, Trump would be subject to disqualification from acquiring federal office. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment directs, "No person shall hold any office under the United States who, having previously taken an oath as an officer of the United States to support the Constitution, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same." There is ample evidence that Donald Trump's objective was the insurrection's success. Among that evidence was his 3-hour delay in calling the attackers to go home, and his vengeful tweet demeaning Vice President Mike Pence, after Trump knew that the savage invasion of the U.S. Capitol had begun. "That was pouring gasoline on the fire," testified former Deputy White House Press Secretary Sarah Matthews. Even without a direct charge of insurrection, allegations of such insurrectionist activities in an indictment for conspiring to defraud the United States or to obstruct the official proceeding of Congress or for seditious conspiracy might suffice for 14th Amendment disqualification if Trump were convicted. Holding Donald Trump accountable and disqualifying him from future office would not be a partisan act, but one needed to preserve the Republic. Without a prosecution of Donald Trump, here are 3 things that seem sure to happen if he were allowed to run again and either be lawfully elected or succeed in installing himself in office despite defeat in the Electoral College, as he attempted to do in 2020. 1. The end of elections in which a majority of American voters choose their leaders. As Judge J. Michael Luttig put it at Thursday's hearing, "The clear and present danger now is because, to this very day, the former president and his allies and supporters pledged that in the presidential election of 2024, if the former president or his anointed successor as the Republican Party presidential candidate were to lose that election, they would attempt to overturn that 2024 election in the same way that they attempted to overturn the 2020 election. Republican-controlled state legislatures are already institutionalizing election sabotage, with GOP election officials determining election results no matter the vote winner. More than a dozen election deniers, like Jim Marchant, who just won the Republican primary for Secretary of State in Nevada, are GOP nominees for Secretary of State and other election-controlling positions. So even though Donald Trump won't hold the levers of presidential power in 2024 the way he did in 2020, he won't need to. His allies and his disinformation are putting officials in place around the country who will certify his win, whatever the vote. Two, the use of military for domestic control. The Trump administration deployed military helicopters in an unprecedented show of military force over peaceful demonstrators whom police attacked in Washington's Lafayette Park in July of 2020. Retired U.S. military leaders excoriated the abuse of power. In early December 2020, Donald Trump's close ally, his former National Security Advisor and retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, reportedly urged Trump to declare martial law in the United States. On 9th of November 2020, Donald Trump fired Defense Secretary Mark Esper and installed a more compliant Christopher Miller. On 4th of January 2021, Christopher Miller issued a memo requiring his approval to deploy the National Guard in Washington, D.C. On 6th of January 2021, Defense Department leadership delayed the National Guard's response to the Capitol siege by 3 hours. You don't have to be a clairvoyant to imagine how military force against political foes and restraint of force to protect violent supporters will be used if Donald J. Trump regains office. And three, the end of accountability. On 17th of June this year, in Nashville, Tennessee, Donald Trump said that if re-elected, he would consider very, very seriously pardoning all of the participants in the 6th of January insurrection. That could clear more than 310 insurrectionists who have pleaded guilty or been convicted at trial. Deterrence of future violence depends on judicially imposed sanctions. Donald Trump would remove them, signaling that violent extremism in defense of Trump is no vice. If he returns to the White House, he will install his people in the Justice Department and turn the machinery of prosecution against his political enemies and towards protecting his friends and his schemes. And should Donald Trump get an encore, look to pre-World War II Germany for a mirror. A failed coup d'etat in 1923 taught Adolf Hitler a better route to dictatorship just 9 years later. Those who repeat history are doomed to learn it the hard way.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
More than 50,000 Britons are refusing to work in the biggest strike in more than three decades. They're protesting their below-inflation pay. London's underground also remains shut. Train services will also be canceled. strike leaders insist the campaign will run for as long as necessary. In Belgium, tens of thousands of people took part in the march in Brussels on Monday, demanding measures to offset record high inflation. Thousands also took to the streets in Ireland after inflation surged to its highest level since the 1980s, prompting cost of living protests across the country. Germany is also facing certain recession if already faltering Russian gas supplies completely stop, and Italy is saying it will consider offering financial backing to help companies refill gas storage to avoid a deeper crisis in winter. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Let's see who is joining me in this episode. Historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling from Bristol. Also with us will be Secretary General of the CIPI Foundation, Paola Raffone. He's joining us out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, Tony, first off, the big picture question. Now, what, in your opinion, is the number one factor responsible for this economic chaos in Europe? Of course, we'll be discussing the situation in some European countries later on in the show.
Well, look, you're hearing my voice. Most people in Britain would never hear my voice, even though I was trained on the BBC to report on these sorts of matters, and they won't see my face. Some would say that's a good thing. But look, it's because I am giving a point of view which is anti-finance capitalism. And it's not just me. It's the leaders of the RMT, Rail Maritime Transport Union, here in Britain that are doing the same. They're saying that finance capitalism is basically killing the entire economy because it's making it impossible for people to afford to live. And therefore, people are being driven out of the industry. So I'm just one of those voices silenced in the UK now because as people like Michael Hudson have pointed out, finance capitalism is killing the host. Its profit is the only thing that matters. And the real problem is that the living costs in Britain and elsewhere have become astronomical. But basically, here in Britain, these are many of the things which were privatised by Margaret Thatcher back in the 1980s, things like electricity, gas, water, housing, all the things, transport as well, by the way, all the things which we need just simply to get by day to day are now in private hands, and those privateers are basically raking off massive profits because they're not contributing anything anymore. They can't compete financially with the rest of the world. An economic failure, Britain and America now are, and much of Europe too, with the notable exception of the Germans. We can't manufacture things because living costs and all these other costs are so high. That's why they call it the cost of living crisis. But the crux of it is rent. How much it costs to house yourself is now roughly 100 times what it costs to, say, for example, to compare it to what it costs to actually build a home, to what it costs to rent and buy a home in Britain today, is 99% of that money is going to people who are making a profit off of your need to find somewhere to live. And the most shattering and shameful thing is that we're hearing it here on press TV, but we're not hearing it anywhere really in the mainstream press in the UK. The fact that effectively we've got a form of capitalism, finance capitalism, which is completely taking over from the old-fashioned capitalism, which was real free market capitalism, where people were paid sensible wages and that the people were making profits in the country. The capitalists weren't preying on people's need for water, fuel, food, energy, and transport, these kind of basic essentials. So That's what's at the bottom of it. But when it comes to the rail strike, we have something like 50,000 people out on strike. They are being very, very clear about they're sending a message to the rest of the public sector workers in Britain, because this is one of the great scandals of the rail strike, the government actually owns three of the large rail franchises here in Britain. The government has flatly refused to even talk to and negotiate with the union. So it's hardly surprising that there's been a strike. It's almost as if the government want a strike. Maybe they want to try and sack all these people and employ robots to do their jobs, or cheap migrant workers who have never been trained to run a railway to do their jobs, because that's the kind of Britain we're living in today.
Okay. Now, Paolo, I want to ask you this question. Is it Russia or the wrong policies of the Western states that have wreaked havoc with this so-called cost of living and soaring energy prices in Europe and the U.S.?
Well, the simplified binary narrative says that is so simple. Everybody understands that this is not the in the West, in the Western economy and finance has started crumbling in 2006, 2008, and it has never recovered to the situation prior to that date. In order to have the system afloat, the governments have been printing quantitative easing, which is creating money out of nowhere, basically, which has allowed a sort of normalcy to appear, but in fact it has devalued the value of those currencies as well as put all the premises for inflation. The pandemic came as a help in the sense that it has been hiding the reality of the economy, which was already in distress. And because of the pandemic, even further quantitative easing has been pulled into the market. Then the pandemic ended. And in fact, a restart of the normal life and economy and consumption has pushed even further the inflationary points, and therefore this has been the situation prior to the Russian military operation. The military operation has increased the situation for Europe, especially for Europe, because it has added the energy supply problem, which has pushed up even further the inflationary data. But we cannot say in a very simplified way that this is the fault of Putin.
Right. Okay, Tony, the European Union is under mounting pressure for spending billions of euros on arming Ukraine. And that's at a time when the bloc's citizens are struggling to make ends meet, as you know. And that was echoed on the streets of Brussels yesterday by ralliers. Still, the U.S. planning to slap more sanctions on Moscow or the war in Ukraine. Is this the right decision?
Well, this is a decision which is being made by an elite cabinet of people who seem to support. So they are in the process of extraditing Julian Assange to the United States, who's one of the greatest investigative journalists of the 21st century and has not committed any crime in Britain whatsoever. That, I'm afraid, is what we have for leaders now in Britain. And the other thing is this matter of inflation, particularly in energy prices. We've now got general inflation, because that's what happens when you start putting up energy prices. Everything starts to cost more. Is actually the cause of that is these new green taxes that the British have brought in. In the UK, we are supposed to have had a Brexit. Now, this is something which has come in right across the European Union. Many of them happening, increases in fuel prices covered up by the oil companies who increased their price before Christmas. This is supposed to be a European thing, but the British have also sneakily, with the collusion of the oil cartels, brought these price increases in fuel in too, and this has a massive knock-on effect. Now they've made an attempt to blame this on the Russians. Of course, that's not gone down very well in Britain, and I don't think that's really succeeded to get through. What's happening, of course, is what we're having is the World Economic Forum, Prince Charles and his green tax friends, Klaus Schwab and the rest of them, are doing a great reset. They're doing it very in slow motion, and what they're doing is they're driving many ordinary people in Britain down into debt. When we're looking at particularly at what's happening with the train strikes, which are really massively affecting the life of Britons over the next week and possibly further into the summer, they've said it possibly even on until Christmas, is the disruption that it's causing to people is enormous. And there seems to be a certain delight within the Green lobby that the energy prices are being forced up and up, and less people have to pay more for their cars. But of course, what this means to the world markets is actually more coal will be being used around the world because oil prices are so high. Also, automation is one of the big reasons for this strike, and this is of course replacing human beings. Employ human beings with decent contracts that the railway staff presently have with automation. So that is to say, within a year or so, the British Railways, the organisers, who, by the way, about a collection of something like 20 or 25 of them get paid anything between £125,000 a year and £800,000 a year for the chief executive. So they're creaming off the money that's coming in from these rail passengers for themselves. But what they're doing is they're using that to then sack the staff because this is what the shareholders like. They like more profit. What they're doing is old-fashioned language is they're sweating the assets. So they're using the assets, they're asset stripping, and they're using the assets to just get rid of all of the costs. And the costs include human beings who look after people's safety on the trains. They want to have even some of these trains with no person on them. So what happens if there's a crash? What happens if there's violence? There's some hooligans, a disturbance on the train. There'll be nobody there to do anything about it. But they don't really care, I'm afraid. The shareholders don't care about that because they've dehumanized these railways using automation. So although it's not just about the railways, I know you want to talk about the other things. I think it's a great example of how in Britain one of the basic bits of infrastructure is being sweated and sweated by the finance capitalists. And finally, they're feeling the pinch. And I hope that there's a settlement in this dispute and that the people can retain their dignity and their decent pay. Some people, by the way, have been sacked from the railways. I was speaking to someone on a train the other day, and they've been told, you're going to have to reapply for your own job, and it's going to be 20% less pay. This is the way they're treating their really important assets who talk to the customers every day. These executives never see a customer, never speak to a rail passenger at all. They just sit in raking in the profits and dishing them out to the shareholders.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Paolo, speaking of the UK, the government is under a lot of pressure, for the economic policies, and this is while the country is facing high inflation. So what is it that the Downing Street and the Johnson administration has failed to do to address the issue?
I didn't get the final part of your question, sorry.
I'm talking about the economic situation and the cost of living crisis, energy prices, and all the economic issues that Britain is facing.
Yeah, but Britain is the best example of what the other interlocutor is saying. In Britain, since the early 80s, have been applied the neoliberal recipes of finance capitalism, and we are seeing what is happening. It's not the first time. The situation is really out of control. Global Britain is a beautiful story that has been circled by Johnson, but in fact, instead of global Britain, there will be a smaller Britain and much poorer than before. That's the reality. But this is something which should be coming as a warning to the rest of the Western countries, because after Britain, there is the US. In the US, the situation is not going any better. Western Europe is strangled with nonsense sanctions and wrong policies which are being implemented, especially in the energy sector. And therefore, the entire Western primacy in economy is under question at this moment.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tony, let's take a glance at Germany. BDI Industry Association has slashed its economic growth forecast for 2020 to 1.5%. It revised it down from 3% expected before the Ukraine war. And it's saying that a halt in the Russian gas deliveries would make recession inevitable. So your assessment of how Germany is impacted?
Well, Germany is likely to be more impacted in many ways than Britain because it's still a very important industrial hub. I mean, they still have in Germany something called industrial capitalism, which is the need to actually make things and sell them in order to make money. And they are very good at it in Germany. The Brits have basically sold out years ago. And the interesting thing for me is the connection with between these policies and NATO and the military policies towards Russia, Iran, and China. Because as Michael Hudson points out in his new book, which is about the, I think it's subtitled, the Future of Civilization, Finance Capitalism, Industrial Capitalism, or Socialism, he's pointed out that we have to keep, and in fact that the war that's going on even now in Russia is really an ideological war in a way between countries that believe that you've just got to be able to sell everything off to the highest bidder, including your national infrastructure, and other countries like Russia, etc., that think that the government has to play an independent role in making sure that the infrastructure of the country is supplied at cost so that people can start businesses and actually compete. What happens is in finance capitalism is everything like here in Britain now. The cost of living becomes so expensive that there is barriers to entry to the market and there's no real entrepreneurialism going on anymore. All the people who got trained in industries are now seem to be working in these other industries like the railways, etc., which are now being sweated. The assets are being sweated there. But we, as a result of all of this, you know, we've got a basic clash of civilizations going on, as Hudson points out, between the West, which is really talking of, where we're talking about finance capitalism, money rules, and the Russians and other powers in the world, which are realistically saying that in order to have sovereignty, the government must assert itself and take control of these various key industries that we've got around the world. And also, of course, we've been seeing protests here in Britain too, hardly covered in the mainstream press because they're embarrassed to see thousands of people out on the streets on Sunday supporting the rail workers and also lobbying the government, protesters, a peaceful protest, lobbying the government, saying we need more government help and intervention to make sure that people can actually afford to feed their children, to pay the rent, to even to maybe have a little bit left to go down the swimming pool and enjoy a day out with the children. That's the sort of thing I'm afraid Britain is now. Britons are now finding it very difficult to afford these things.
Okay, now, Paula, let's take a look at Italy now. You know, alongside Italy, alongside others such as Germany, Denmark, Austria, and Netherlands, has activated the first early warning stage of its three-stage plan to cope with a gas supply crisis. So let's take a look at the situation in Italy and how badly that country is affected.
Well, the choices that the European Union made, especially in the gas sector, in terms of policy, were evidently wrong when they decided to adhere to the concept of spot prices for the gas. This is now turning as a boomerang on the economies of Europe because prices are going up. We have to import this gas from somewhere else than Russia at prices that will be skyrocketing. All of this will increase the malfunctioning of the economy and the social unrest. This is clear. Families already in many countries find difficult to reach the end of the month to pay the bills and the rents. Prices are so high, evidently. I mean, it's not just a matter of statistics. It's enough to go to the market and buy your daily food, and you will see how prices have doubled. And we are here talking about little measures of the central bank to contrast an inflation which is far beyond the official rate, evidently.
Okay. Now, Tony, the sky-high European price has attracted more LNG cargoes, but Europe lacks the infrastructure to meet all its needs from LNG, and that's why the global LNG market is already stretched. Disruptions to a major U.S. producer of also liquefied natural gas that provided shipments to Europe added to this challenge. So what's in the offing?
Well, that's a good question, Tim. Look, by saying we're going to take Russian energy, the Brits have really shot themselves in the foot massively. I mean, this is a stupid thing to do, unless, of course, you want to create a crisis in your domestic economy and amongst your domestic people. I think this is just how crazy some of our leaders are in this part of the world, is they realise that they can't beat the Russians. The Russians are actually too tough, and their soldiers are, and their, you know, nuclear weapons are very, very strong too. So they've turned their ire on their own people. That's the only explanation I can see for this masochistic idea of completely cutting off gas and oil, which the Europeans and the British seem to want to do, and the Americans. And now, of course, this benefits the Americans. So it means the Americans are going to be able to sell more of their energy to Europe. And that, I think, is the real agenda, that this is a way of just knuckling down the Europeans to be obedient to American wishes. But we've got a massive structural problem, and that is that the governments we elect have really got very little or no power anymore. The people who are really running the show are the oil cartels, the banks. You know, the people like the Bilderberg conferences, which I've been studying for many years, these are groups of elites, including the media. And what shocks me as a former, shall we say, civil servant journalist here in Britain, is to see that the editors of the media here in the West go to these secret conferences and swear secrecy. They don't write about them. They won't tell anybody what goes on in there, because largely because their assets of their businesses and many of their bonuses come from the fact that many of these top executives around the Western world have got their money squirreled away in these tax havens. They're not paying any tax, whilst what's happening is the middle classes and the poorest people in Europe and around the West are now paying the tax that they should be paying. So that's, I'm afraid, the structural problem that's at the heart of this. And I think it's fairly clear to say that this is the sort of thing that the Russians are simply not prepared to put up with in Eastern Europe, nor are people in Donbass and the Donetsk. By the way, 15,000 of which have been killed by the Ukrainian army over the last, with the collusion of the West and people like Victoria Nuland, over the last 8 years since the 2014 coup there. People are not prepared to accept this. Also in Ukraine, by the way, when the coup happened in 2014, what you saw was a cutting of the money going to the regions in Ukraine. All of it was then concentrated in the center, and it was starving the regions of the cash that they were paying the tax and that they need to carry on. So it's a structural problem, the finance capitalists taking over governments right across the West, and the Russians, etc., the Iranians, the Chinese are not going to have that.
Okay. Paolo, we have 1 minute left. Tell us if you know of any exits out of this situation.
Well, in one thing, this is quite a challenge, but the best way is to start recognizing that the Western supremacy is over. That's the reality. It's an important part of the world economy and power, but it's no more the only one, and cannot be in the position of dictating to the rest of the world what to do. So if this would happen, it means that our leaders would be capable of sitting down with the rest of the world and try to redefine an order which is beneficial to all.
Okay. On that note, we'll come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling in Bristol and Secretary General of the CIPF Foundation, Paolo Raffone in Brussels. And thank you for watching this edition of The Spotlight. I've been your host, Behrouz Najaf, and I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wassalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice regent, imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kazim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام اجعلوا لأنفسكم حظا من الدنيا بإعطائها ما تشتهي من الحلال وما لا يثلم المروة وما لا سرف فيه واستعينوا بذلك على أمور الدين فإنه روي ليس منا من ترك دنياه لدينه أو ترك دينه لدنياه.
Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam stated, allocate for yourselves a portion of